Welcome back. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. According to a recent survey by the Associated Press, more than 15% of Americans live at or below the poverty line. And for a family of four, the federal government says that's $23,000. And that number is expected to rise when new figures come out from the census in the fall. That means more people will be living below the poverty line than at any time since President Johnson made his famous declaration of war on poverty as he campaigned in 1964. Of course, in contrast to 1964, in this presidential election year, the major party candidates are not spending their time visiting poor communities, talking about their plans to combat poverty. But in spite of the near absence of a national discussion about poverty, there's a growing and vibrant movement to confront it from the bottom up. And on today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by looking at grassroots efforts to bring families and communities out of poverty. One of those efforts is the Family Independence Initiative, a nonprofit started in Oakland that works to increase the social and economic mobility of low-income families. You may have heard them profiled on NPR's All Things Considered a few weeks ago. And today we're joined by its vice president, Mia Birdsong. Mia, thanks for joining the program.
Absolutely. Good morning.
Great to have you with us. Now, later in the show, we're going to hear from Ramona Shule, who is one of the women who has participated in the Family Independence Initiative. Also joining us today is Ethel Longscott. She's executive director of the Women's Economic Agenda Project, which works to change policies to raise the role and visibility of poor and working people in crafting real solutions to the economic and social injustices of our time. Ethel, great as always to have you on the program.
And thank you for having me.
Thanks so much. And here with me in studio is Lauren Needle. He's the Chief Community Investment Officer at United Way Bay Area, which has made its mission to reduce poverty in the Bay Area by half before 2020. Thank you, Lauren, for being with us here today.
Great to be here, Matt.
And we also want you, listeners, to be part of this conversation in this hour. I invite you to think about poverty not as a news item or as a statistic, but as someone you know. Is it a family member or a neighbor, maybe a kid at your child's school, or maybe it's you and your family? Because we know even in relatively affluent counties like Marin, poverty rates run at about 10%, and they go up from there. And we all know that the federal poverty standard, which is a little dubious anywhere in the country, certainly doesn't cut it here in the Bay Area and in Northern California. So if you are someone struggling to make it on a limited income in this expensive part of the world, we want to hear from you. What would make a difference for you in your life? If you have known people who have found their way out of poverty, how did it happen? And if you're someone who's concerned about growing economic inequality and you're seeing its impact where you live or where you work, what questions do you have about what's happening and about how you can get involved? It is your call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I want to start with a couple of kind of broad questions, and Ethel, maybe I'll start with you. I was just asking listeners to think about this subject in a really personal way. But we live, you know, and to, you know, someone who they know lives in poverty, or perhaps themselves, someone who's found their way out of it, but we live in this really economically segregated society, which means that, you know, there's a lot of times when poor people and middle-class people and rich people don't know their realities, each other's realities, very well. Are there any key misconceptions about who poor people are and how they live that you think distort the way that we're approaching this subject?
Sure. I think that this conversation is so long overdue. And even if you think about the notions of how many poor, we're getting close to the official number that we have, you know, around about 50 million that we haven't been
as high
as that.
Ethel, my apologies. We're having a bit of a problem with the line. We're going to give you a call right back, and I'm going to want you to follow up on that very thought when we get you back on the line. Mia, let me bring this question to you. Any important misconceptions that we should try to get out of the way here at the beginning?
I think that poor people are often seen as different from upper and middle income people, and we don't apply the same kinds of incentive-based systems that we have for upper and middle income people to fighting poverty and creating economic mobility. I mean, I think you have these very polarized views, you know, on the right, you know, poor folks are considered moochers or lazy, and there's kind of this whole, you know, culture of poverty thing. And I think that, you know, those of us on the left really need to take a take a look at the way that we sometimes are kind of paternalistic about how we look at poor folks, and we think that we need to provide an enormous amount of direction and instruction in order for people to move forward. And I think in our work, and I think for, and certainly from my personal experience, I know that that's not the case. You know, low-income folks, the difference between low-income folks and upper and middle-income folks is resources, access, you know, accessing financial capital and social capital. And those are, and if we think about it in those terms, it's I think we'd make a lot more progress in terms of what we're trying to do in terms of increasing people's mobility.
Ethel Longscott, we've got your back, right?
Yes.
All right. You see, you want to follow up on what Mia had to say and finish up your thought as well, misconceptions.
Sure. I mean, I think that the key thing is that there are many more people who struggle with poverty than we are kind of highlighted to believe. You know, the number is closer to about 150 million people are poor or near poor.
What does that mean? I've heard that. Describe, break that down.
So if we just use the income, the asset of how our country values, if you have assets, we determine it by your so-called wealth as opposed to your quality of life. And if you are in, if a family of four is earning a few dollars more than $23,000 a year, but you can't always feed your family, or you're struggling between feeding your family and paying the rent, or paying your mortgage, or you often go without paying your health care premiums because they are more than your mortgage. I mean, these things were not. These are things that cloud the picture of how the new kind of poverty that we're facing, or that workers are facing in this country. The other thing is, with the tremendous amount of lack of unemployment and the structural unemployment that people are facing, we have young people who are not seeing the day of light of new work or new jobs, and or they're becoming debt slaves. They're encumbering phenomenal debt in order to try and get better jobs. There's no mechanism that measures how that translates into poverty, or it has an impact of having people take very bad jobs because they are, in effect, debt slaves now.
No,
this thing is bigger than what it's more interwoven in the fabric of our lives and our work, and it actually could be our neighbors and our friends more often than not.
Ethel Longscott, thanks for that. Lauren Needles, you want to come in from United Way?
Yeah, I think Ethel's absolutely right. I do a lot of public speaking in front of groups at companies who are involved with the United Way, community groups, et cetera. And all I have to do is say to the audience, you know, raise your hand if there's someone in your family who's in poverty and hands go up. Raise your hand if there's a coworker, a neighbor, a friend you have. Raise your hand if you were ever in that situation. And it's very close and personal for a lot of us. It may not seem like it is, but once people actually start to think through their friend who lost their home, or that cousin who never seems to be able to get a job and they give money to when they can, it becomes much more real for all of us. And, you know, we at United Way have joined a growing number of folks who use a measure called the self-sufficiency standard that's been developed in the last 10 years that gets more precise than the federal poverty line. And to Ethel's point, if you add up the cost of food, housing, childcare, healthcare, et cetera, you know, $23,000 a year isn't enough for a family of four. In fact, double that, $46,000 a year isn't enough for a family of four in most cities in the Bay Area. And so you have people that are going without things, people that are not healthy, people whose children are left alone while they're at work, you know, sort of the silent evidence of poverty. And of course, that doesn't stay silent for long. You see real problems happen in people's lives.
So each of you have really drawn out some different strands about what might not be understood, you know, going beyond those statistics, the 15% that the federal government is talking about. I want to go back to you, Mia, and your work with the Family Independence Initiative. I mean, you specifically talk about this question of, you know, financial and social capital and how to use incentives, you know, in working, in helping bring people out of poverty. How does that express itself in the work you do?
Well, just to provide some more context, we have two different systems in this country for social welfare. We have the, you know, kind of the one that people think of mostly, which is the safety net system, that is a needs-based system. It's for folks who are in crisis, but it doesn't really create, it's not creating a path of mobility for people. It doesn't create a springboard out, because if people make progress, we know that their benefits get taken away from them. On the other side of the income spectrum, we have a very different system for wealthier folks, who that encourages them to maintain or build their wealth. So, for example, I put money in my 401k plan and my employer matches it. I bought a house and I'm able to write off my mortgage interest. There are a whole set of systems and benefits that are funded for folks on this end of the income spectrum. And it's all based on our initiative. And what we have in the middle is very little. So the safety net system ends at about 120% of poverty, which is maybe $25,000 for a family of four. And we know, and this is part of what Ethel was saying, is that people are not stable there. They're just making these decisions about, do I pay my health insurance or do I pay my mortgage? And you don't get any meaningful supports until you reach about $80,000. And right now we just don't have anything in the middle, which is where most people in this country live. So what FII has been showing for the past decade is that you can provide a really broad range of benefits for folks who exist in that space. It's much more like the one that we have for upper and middle income folks. It allows people to choose the things that are going to help them move forward. And that's really what FII's work is about. It's about, really allowing people to make their own choices around their lives. It's allowing them to work together to do those things. If we look historically at how communities have created pathways out of poverty, if you look at Black folks after slavery or, different waves of immigrants, what people did is they pooled their resources and they created these pathways so that people who were in the community knew what steps they could take in order to get out of poverty, and they had other people around them helping. And we've shown that you can really catalyze that kind of community building and that kind of social capital so that people can move forward.
I think that's
a great point. And I might add, the thing that happened was also these huge government infrastructures were also developed parallel to that process when you look at the migration of African Americans from the South and to the North, escaping all kinds of tyranny, and the kinds of, in education, in social services, in things that help to buttress families, immigrant families, poor families that were struggling, it really made a difference. What we're seeing today is a part of a world global process where essentially global corporations are having great authority and great discretion, and they are pummeling. We have an austerity process. It's not officially called that, but that is what we're facing. So I don't care who you are. If you are a steel worker that had a great job in 1980, it's not likely. I mean, you have likely been on a decline. Maybe your kids have gotten a better job. But the schools that were there here in California, community colleges, are being just battered. They're being destroyed. The infrastructure that was there to help push up families is being destroyed. And the workers who are part of building that, their institutions are being rammed as well. So I think we are looking at a major reorganization, a social contract of the 20th century versus a social contract of the 21st century. And we're all in this big mix, and most families are fighting to keep their heads above water. We heard testimony in Oakland where many of our professors have students who are living in their cars and coming to school as they try to improve themselves. This isn't a third world country. This is right here in our country. It's abysmal what is happening. So we have a whole cast of workers who are just really being thrown into the pits, and then those who think they're in the middle, they are threatened as well.
Ethel, I want to get response from our listeners, people who are living through these kind of changes that you're talking about, these global changes that are having this real impact on the ground. If you'd like to join the conversation on Your Call, the number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We are talking about the big picture of poverty in the United States and making it local, talking about grassroots solutions that are happening here in the Bay Area. If you are someone who's struggling to make it on a limited income, if you have been poor and have found a way out of poverty, we'd love to hear your story. What makes a difference? What can work in this really difficult context that Ethel Longscott from the Women's Economic Agenda Project, as well as Mia Birdsong from the Family Independence Initiative, and Lauren Needle from the United Way are talking about? The number to call, 866-798-8255. You can also email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We actually got an email from a listener who talks about the fact that, is kind of talking about this in the middle, just out of the poverty rate area, how people are not surviving. She says, to qualify for the CARE program that reduces your energy bill, you have to have an income level so low that very few people qualify. And she says that because of her husband's disability check, she doesn't qualify. So basically, you know, you got the Mitt Romney, hey, there's a safety net for the people at the very bottom, and then otherwise find a way up. Lauren, United Way, you're working with a lot of different groups as well as the United Way's own initiatives. What are some of the solutions you're saying or things that might be working to help people in the middle there, trying to make that step out?
Well, this is not an easy problem to solve, or we would have solved it by now, because a lot of us care about the people who are struggling. The good news is that there's a lot of good work going on around the Bay Area, and not only United Way's work, but many of the partners that we are connected with. But let me talk about one of the things that we're doing. We operate a set of 10 centers around the Bay Area that are called Spark Point Centers. We serve 7 counties, so that stretches from Fremont is the furthest southern one, all the way up to Napa, American Canyon, and San Francisco, and Oakland, and points in between. And even though we've only been at this about 3 years, the Spark Point Center has served almost 4,000 people last year. And they're exactly the kind of folks like the person who sent you an email, people that are above the poorest of the poor, but far from safe, far from stable, and need some help to get themselves to a self-sufficient life. And we hope for a life of dignity and sufficiency for everybody. So here's what happens at the Spark Point Centers. Think of it as one place where you can come and use all the different services and opportunities you need to move yourself forward. We measure a few things. We measure whether people are raising their income, whether they're increasing their savings, whether they're getting out of debt, which is a big problem for a lot of people in poverty, and whether they're able to improve their credit, because once you cross a credit score of 650 or so, you can get a loan for a car, you can get a loan for a home, and so forth. And the way we do this is we invite the best organizations in the Bay Area to come inside these Spark Point Centers and offer their services. So if you were to walk into the Spark Point Center in San Mateo County at Skyline College, you would find organizations that are terrific at job training. You'd find organizations that are great at financial education, organizations that do credit counseling, and so on and so on. And there are professionals there, so if you or I walk into the Spark Point Center, you're greeted. It's not like people's misconception of a social service office where nobody cares and you wait for 3 hours. You're welcomed. You're celebrated. You come in the door. You get a coach for free, and that coach says, what's your plan? Where do you want to go with your life? And over the next 2 or 3 years, let's help you use these different services to get yourself there. And what's really exciting, even though it's early on, is we're collecting data on what's happening. And last year, almost 60% of the people that were in the Spark Point Centers using the services were increasing their income, increasing their savings, showing other progress out of poverty. And we think that's a terrific way to start. And we think it's a complicated problem, and you need a solution that touches the different parts of the problem in one easy way. Last thing I'll say, in those 10 Spark Point Centers across the Bay Area, 70 different partner organizations, public and private, lots of people coming together to try and work on the problem.
So if people want to find a Spark Point Center, what's the easiest way for them to get to it?
The very easiest thing to do is call 211, a 3-digit dial on your phone, another service that United Way offers for free. You can call up 211 and get referral to any social services, public or private, in any county in the Bay Area. And if you call up 211 and ask for the Spark Point Center nearest you, they'll connect you.
All right. We've got a lot of folks calling in at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK here on Your Call. I want to go to Paul in Santa Cruz. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you taking my call. I just wanted to interject a different perspective on this question of poverty. I've been involved with an organization in Oakland that's fought for community control of housing, of education, for Higher Oakland First policies, and has really tried to emphasize economic development versus police containment, because it seems like public policy goes to more police and more containment versus economic development. And so I'm sad that they're not a part of this conversation, the Uhuru movement. But the perspective they've given me is this, that poverty is profitable. It's not accidental. And that one community profits off the loss and lack and poverty of another, that it's kind of more of a parasitic and structural relationship rather than just a lack of employment or a lack of will to work. And I think that's really an important part of this conversation.
Hey, Paul, thank you so much for bringing it in. I'd like to actually just take that around our panel. I mean, earlier, you know, Lauren was saying, hey, this is a tough issue. That's why, you know, it's like this is hard to solve. That's why it hasn't been done yet. Paul brings in the perspective of saying, well, in fact, there's some pretty powerful interests that might actually like to not see this solved. Let's take this around. Mia.
You know, I think that
I don't know that the powerful interest thing is going to shift a lot, but I do think that one of the things that the caller was saying that's important is that communities really have control over themselves. And the self-determination piece, I think, is something that is often left out of the conversation when we talk about how we're going to actually create economic mobility and pathways out of poverty. Programs absolutely have a role, and policy absolutely has a role. But the people who have the best ideas about how they're going to move their families out of poverty or their communities out of poverty are the people who are experiencing it. And if we can make available to them the resources that they want on demand, you know, whether it's nano loans or the kinds of opportunities we have, like, again, for lower and upper income folks, if we can make these resources available, they will move themselves forward. And we've been working with folks, hundreds of families, for decades. We don't provide any direct services. We don't provide training. We don't provide, we don't have a bunch of requirements in terms of how they can access these things other than working with us. And we've found that families can move themselves forward. And I think that self-determination piece, which is what I took out of what the caller was saying, is really critical.
Ethel Longscott?
Yeah, I think that this is a real crucial question that the caller raised, and it really underscores for me the basic notion that the system's broken, not the people. And when you are the one on the receiving end of these things, frequently it can be interpreted that, well, you know, the public workers just don't work hard enough, so we need to summarily dismiss them, get rid of union contracts, destroy their pensions. These things are very interconnected. We're in a struggle in our city where we have just seen the constant onslaught of the contracting out, and that has had an impact in terms of reducing services in our city, as well as workers losing jobs and crucial employment. Crucial to this is proposals that workers are putting forward to change that. For instance, with Goldman Sachs, who we all know got great gobs of money, our public money, earlier, and they made these various, very sweetheart deals with municipalities, and they're gouging us. And efforts by some of the labor unions to have those debts forgiven have taken on both local and national lives. Each time that happens, those efforts put more cash in the base in terms of our respective cities. But there is another point, and that is we need a broader vision. And that vision isn't that, right now it seems to me we're basically in a responsive mode where frequently we're saying, well, we got to exclude some people. Some people, basic human rights can be ignored. And I think that is a recipe for disaster for us, but it makes gobs of money for these global corporations. So we need to understand that whether we like it or not, these lines in the way that your caller raised are really, they're a part of what is the context of informing everything that we're dealing with. And more, this dialogue we're having, which must become a national discussion, that we need a full effort to eliminate poverty in America, not to erase the human beings who are poor.
That's Ethel Longscott. She's the executive director of the Women's Economic Agenda Project. Also with us this morning on Your Call is Lauren Needle. He's the chief community investment officer at the United Way Bay Area, which has made its mission to reduce poverty in the Bay Area by half by 2020. And on the line also is Mia Birdsong. She's the vice president of the Family Independence Initiative. We also want to hear from you. What's the bigger vision that you would have for taking on poverty and thinking of it from the grassroots level? We've talked about the inadequacies of the national discussion, obviously Ethel Longscott talking about the really global dimensions of this, but at the local level, what's the vision you think can actually make change in your community? If you're someone who's come out of poverty, what made a difference? If you know people who are living in poverty, what could help them take that step out? 866-798-8255. You're listening to Your Call. We'll be back after this.
I Every Tuesday, the Your Call team sends out a weekly email newsletter that tells you what's coming up on the show and gives you resources to let you learn more and get involved. Subscribe today so you'll know what's coming up and can submit your questions and comments before the show goes on the air. It's free and easy to sign up. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org. And you can participate in today's show by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
You are listening to Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We are podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our email newsletter to keep up on what is coming up on the program. Today, we are talking about poverty, which right now in the U.S. is approaching its highest rates since Lyndon Johnson declared war on poverty in 1964. Of course, it's not part of the national political debate. If you're listening to President Obama, if you're listening to Mitt Romney and most of the politicians in Washington, and yet at the grassroots level, there are some very exciting and innovative efforts going on to try to say, what is the big picture and how do we bring it down to the local level and find solutions? That's what we're talking about today. We'd love you to be part of the conversation at 866-798-8255 or to email feedback@yourcallradio.org. With us are Lauren Needle. He is the Chief Community Investment Officer at United Way Bay Area, Ethel Longscott, Executive Director of the Women's Economic Agenda Project, and also Mia Birdsong. She's the Vice President of the Family Independence Initiative. You can find information about all of their organizations at yourcallradio.org. I want to come back to talk about this broader vision that Ethel Longscott was talking about. And I know that at the United Way Bay Area, Lauren, you all made a really remarkable commitment, this idea of we're going to set this goal of reducing poverty in the Bay Area by 2020, by half. And you've done it through a really broad set of, you know, broad set of connections you're trying to make in this community. What made that, you know, what made that vision come forward in the United Way? And then how do you see, what do you see those visionary things happening on the ground that you're working with?
Well, it's a moral imperative for us. We, our board of directors made that decision 2 years ago, and they made that decision looking around at the Bay Area where the recession was certainly putting a lot more people in jeopardy and in poverty. But even before the recession, there were people who were locked in poverty and struggling. And it's been our mission for almost 90 years to help the most vulnerable people in our society. And our board said, you know, we've got to really commit to that. And we've got to take on something big, because if we think we're leaders, we need to reach for the important work. And so we declared that we were going to set this goal of cutting poverty in half by 2020. We then talked to a lot of people in the communities that we serve. We did a process of community conversations, talked to more than 500 people across the seven counties, including a number of people in poverty, to Mia's earlier point, that asked them what would help them, what are their goals for themselves, et cetera, and that infused a lot of that. And then we and a bunch of partners emerged with a blueprint that we call the Roadmap to Cut Poverty. It's a giant to-do list, essentially. And it says that we need to do policy work, like my colleagues have mentioned, that we need to have the right programs and services like the Spark Point Centers, and that we need to mobilize on the ground, that we need people in communities to have a stake in this. And we believe that people can change their own futures and that there are a lot of other people of goodwill who will join them to make that happen. So a couple of concrete examples. In Solano County and in Contra Costa County, we are privileged to be partners in some really terrific organizing that's going on. In Solano County, there's a group that calls itself the Safety Net Task Force that looked at both the safety net that the county was providing, but also looked at everything going on in the community and said, you know, we can do better for people here in poverty in Solano. And so we have been co-hosting those meetings, and you're talking about people from all sectors, small business people and corporate people, government and nonprofit, community leaders, people in poverty at the table coming together. And that group has laid out an exciting agenda, looking at what they can do about some things in education, looking at actually mapping what the, quote, system is doing or not doing well and how we can support and improve that. And we've even taken what I would call a really important experimental step, looking into strategies where it's not about the services, as someone said, but about people's personal level of hope and resilience. And how do you help individuals who've been stuck in poverty move themselves forward.
And I actually want to bring in a couple of folks who've called in and want to talk about their experiences, their perspective. And we have Diana in San Francisco. Welcome to your call.
Oh, hi. I will only say that I am a 65-year-old homeless woman, actually parked right on Fell Street, across from my hippie house that we rented for $100 a long time ago. And I buy socks and blankets for the other homeless people and try to take care of them. And my dream is to get some land for organic farming for the homeless and to give them a sense of self-dignity and respect. But the thing I see is that it's each person out there in the community, and like the young gentleman just was speaking about different groups helping. And unfortunately, the government's not doing what it should be doing. And if we have people who do kind of keep an eye on them and try to make them do some decent things and keep community groups helping, that even just a dollar or a couple dollars sometimes to a person who's in a difficult state of mind can make a big difference. And that's all I wanted to say. I see great hope in community, and it has to come from the people, because people really care. People give me a couple dollars, and then I'm able to buy blankets and able to cover up those poor people who are sleeping on the sidewalk. And it breaks my heart that in this great country that we have these people carrying their trash bags and shopping carts. So keep up the good work.
Diana,
thank you very much.
Thanks for being part of the conversation and for calling in. I want to go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Greg, thanks for calling into your call.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you for the program. Gosh, I have to turn the radio down. Sorry.
You're listening to Your Call. This is the number to call if you want to join the conversation like Greg did. Is 866-798-8255. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, I happen to be on SSI, and so I'm on $854 a month living in poverty. I'm fortunate enough to have a place to live, and I'm glad that this program's taking place, because I think to a great extent, at least maybe in the Bay Area, and I happen to live in Palo Alto, poor people are seemingly invisible. Mm-hmm. And the government, I'm not sure what the attitudes are of the politicians. I think that in my city in Palo Alto, much more could be done to assist people who are living in poverty or living on very low incomes. One thing that I would like to hope to see happen, and I think Dr. King was working in this direction with the Poor People's Campaign, would be, and this is incredibly difficult to do, but some way of organizing poor people, if you could do it, so that there would be some movement by that body of people to try and address the situation, the circumstances that they live in, because I'm not sure that you're going to get much help from the government. And in my situation, and I'm sure the situation of other people, millions of other people in this country, really feel trapped in the system that they're in. So I just want to thank you for this program, and I hope that this is a continuing conversation.
Well, Greg, thanks for the call. Valuable perspective. Ethel Longscott, talk about that question of mobilizing poor people.
Yeah. First of all, I just want to thank both of those callers. They are really exercising what it means to be government and the phenomenal vision that exists in our country. I think that what that caller hit on and the caller before is that we are going to need to transform our economy. If you look at some of the things we deliberated on in the courts of women, was some of our allies are working on something called a financial transaction tax or Robin Hood tax. And it's a small little thing that would essentially, there are billions of dollars of financial transactions that happen in Wall Street every day, and they are not taxed. If we could have a portion of those things taxed, these pieces that we need to keep body and soul alive, to help people live lives with with dignity, could be a real possibility. I think that the interconnection of proposals that the National Nurses Union has put forward, or CNA here has put forward, that would help, for instance, us to support real Medicare for all as opposed to a simple subsidy to the insurance industry. These are priorities. These are visions that mean we have to work in a different way to elevate new values and priorities. But that, we learned some things from the movement to take down apartheid in America, which was a segregated America. And that was, we had to work in the courts, in public policy, and in the streets. And by that, I don't mean tearing up stuff. I mean making our, demonstrating our citizenry. Sometimes it did mean, you know, staying the hand of the dogs and the cops. But we had to have a bigger vision of what, of a world that was possible, because in that immediate instance, it was not. The politics of exclusion and destruction of people that we don't like, it is unfortunately what is more and more gaining steam. We need a vision that informs how do we put these powerful new technological tools to helping us heal our people and really build an economy that takes care of all, as opposed to say that if you are on, quote, a fixed income, an elderly person, or disabled, get out of our way, we're not going to look at you, blah, blah, blah. I mean, this is the heartlessness that is developing in our country, and I was just really struck by the phenomenal citizenry of the people who phoned, because to me, they're representing some of the best in our country.
Well, I guess I want to get Mia Birdsong in on this. I mean, this kind of, so you have this dominant political narrative, which, to the extent that it brings poor people into it, often, you know, demonizes or marginalizes them. But,
right.
You know, we got the call, we got this call here from Greg, who's saying it's really about poor people mobilizing themselves, both, you know, in terms, you know, about politically.
I think it can be. And I think that that there needs to be, you know, unless the demand is heard from low-income folks, you know, politicians are not really going to respond. We know that that's the case. I also think there is a way of mobilizing people that's not necessarily about political motivation, but is mobilization, but is really about mobilizing community building. You know, the first caller, the first of those two callers,
Diana,
talking about the folks who, yes, who gave her a little money so she could buy, you know, blankets for homeless folks. When we talk to families who have, you know, have been on welfare or are, you know, collecting subsidies, they are still getting, you know, anybody who's on welfare and is living in public housing is getting help with childcare or something from somebody. They're not getting by on whatever it is that they're getting from, you know, their check from the state or from WIC or whatever. People always have to put together a little bit more from in order to make it. I mean, the families that we work with in San Francisco, 30% of them started side businesses to get through the recession. But they can't grow those businesses because they can't get investment in them, same way that somebody, you know, a 22-year-old MBA from Harvard could get millions of dollars dropped in their lap because of the social connections that they have. But our families can't get those kinds of investments, even if they've, you know, we have families who've been trying to open restaurants and they've been working in the restaurant business for 20 years, but because they're low income, they don't have collateral, they don't have those kinds of connections. If we could make those kinds of resources available to folks, they would be able to kind of mobilize, you know, the changing of the economy that Ethel's talking about, you know, on the community level. The families that we work with who have started businesses, you know, they employ themselves, obviously, and then they, you know, they hire teenagers in their community. They hire their family members. There is this kind of grassroots building of the economy, I think, that we could stimulate if we made the same kinds of resources that we make for upper and middle income people available to folks at the other end of the ladder. And again, I totally think there's an important role for policy to play. There's an important role for programs to play, but we need to really be resourcing low-income folks differently so that they can play the role that they want to play.
Mia, we have on the line someone who has been involved with the Family Independence Initiative, Ramona Shule. Ramona, welcome to your call. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So good for you to give us some time this morning. So tell a little bit about your story and how you got involved with the Family Independence Initiative and how you've taken this on.
Okay. So in August 2010, I was told by someone by the name of Lenika, who was part of the Family Independence Initiative, and she invited a bunch of us in our group that we were running to join. And she mentioned how you could give data to Families Independence Initiative, and they give you a stipend for that data. And they also will help you with a laptop so that you can put your data into that monthly. And so I was like, what? And I was working for a nonprofit agency and in grad school and was doing my homework at work. And so the laptop was, like, real appealing for me to do my grad work. So I joined, and since I joined, it has just opened up opportunities for me for growth. My financial portfolio is phenomenal. My credit score was like in the 400s, it's now in the 7s. You know, each month I report data around savings, around group IT training, and it just has opened up so many doors for me. I am in grad school, and I'm getting my master's in counseling psychology, and FII has really helped me with scholarships and IDA match, and just, you know, being a part of Families Independence Initiative, I'm able to show leadership. I'm able to be a role model to my family. I have two sons who one is a probation officer and the other is in his senior year in high school. And I'm able to just show them how education and saving for your future is so key and important. And Family Independence Initiative helps me to do that. They give me the tools to end poverty in my family. And being a part of this wonderful project has just been phenomenal.
So part of it just helping you kind of track where your finances are, thinking about these questions, how you move forward. But another part of it is really somewhat me is talking about this community building, whether it's inside your family or with other people in the group. You talked about there was a group you were already part of before you connected up with FII.
Yeah, I work for a nonprofit agency, and I began a group in 2006 called the Peer Parent Support Group, and it's for families who have child protective services cases, either open or closed, and they can come and just talk about how child protective services has played a role in their lives, whether good or bad, it's safe and it's comfortable for them to speak openly and honestly. And so that's been going strong for almost 7 years. So just being a part of that group, we get information, and the information for Families Independence came out of that group.
So Ramona, in this discussion we're having about, you know, we have this huge problem of poverty in this country, and we're trying to break it down to the kind of local level and say, what are solutions at the grassroots that can make a difference? From your experience, what are some of the most important elements of making that happen?
Well, I think it's really taking a look at where you're at, where you want to go, and how you're going to get there. And it's networking. It's being around people who are productive and who show initiative in living, you know, a life that is substantial. Education is key. Saving, you know, putting away money monthly for your children, for your future, working hard. I work at this nonprofit. I work with Families Independence Initiative. And I also have another job. And so, you know, just being accountable, making sure that you live a life that isn't poverty stricken, by getting a good education, by networking with people who want the same thing you want, and that's to have a family that's seeds and a family that grows, and just by working hard and making sure that, you know, your legacy goes on. And that's where I think education comes in. Just working hard, putting family first, just community building, helping the community where you can and making a difference.
Well, Ramona, thank you so much for making a difference in this conversation, bringing in your experience with the Family Independence Initiative. Really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
And if listeners want to learn more about the FII, there was actually a piece on All Things Considered on National Public Radio a few weeks ago, and at yourcallradio.org, you can listen to that there and learn more about the stories of Ramona and some of the other women involved in the project. I mean, obviously, Mia, you know this project very well, but I'm interested, Lauren and Ethel, listening in, you know, what you take from your experiences hearing Ramona's story and the progress she's been able to make, how you reflect on that from what you know in your work. Lauren Needle.
Well, I think, Ramona, first of all, it's inspiring to hear your story, Ramona, so thank you. I think there's some essential truths about how we move ahead that Ramona really touched on. One is that you have to believe in people, that people can and will move themselves and their families to a better place with the right opportunity, with the right support. Secondly, that sometimes the problem is a problem of access to information or a certain opportunity. Sometimes the problem is the right support, getting through the other barriers in your life. And sometimes the problem is structural. And if we are really thoughtful about looking at each of those and either creating the doorway or getting the barrier out of the way for people, there's a lot of room for good things to happen. You know, in our Spark Point centers, just to connect to Ramona's story, we've started to see some people who are unemployed become homeowners. We've started to see people who were in debt get their credit back up to the point where they can get a student loan and so forth. And not only are those people helping themselves, but almost uniformly, the first thing they say to us is, how do I help out the next person coming through the Spark Point Center? There's something about the human spirit and something about wanting to bring your community with you that's very powerful. And what we try to do in our work is make sure that we tap people as community resources. To me, that's community building. And once those people are not only helping themselves, but helping each other, they also become a political force in the most positive way.
Ethel Longscott, I wanted to come to you because in hearing Ramona's story where she's talking about the power of having this laptop that she got to work with, I was thinking of what came out of the U.S. Courts on Women in Poverty that you convened. And one of the key findings, you're saying that any serious discussion of poverty, jobs, and education have to be grounded in the fact that we're shifting from a labor-based economy to a technology-based economy. How do we do that concretely?
I think that is at the heart of this, what Ramona's story really illustrates, that when you are not the victim of this kind of new racism that we're facing, where it labels individuals in poverty as criminals or makes it justifies gutting education or these various opportunities, that we can really see that people can flourish. And I think that it revisits this notion that we need government that really we need to do what the industries are doing. They go and they fight for subsidies. They fight for things to be, to benefit their businesses. We've got to fight that these phenomenal technological tools, just in the way that Ramona described them, become new tools for liberating humanity. Our problem is we're not having that discussion beyond places like this, on this very basic level, that we have a big change in the economy. We actually have a big change in work. The unemployment is structural. It's not just a matter of people's attitudes. Lots of professionals are admitting this huge number of young people who are structured out of new jobs. But there is work that needs to be done. There's healing that needs to be done. And Ramona really touched on that as well. So we need to have this happen not as accidental, but very deliberate. And as we think about the complexities of these things, that we have whole industries that are really benefiting from jailing more human beings, more people than any other nation in the world, that, you know, really we're talking direction. And I think what the various callers have illustrated is that we're kind of at this pivot point, and we've got to deal with elevating the conversation of eliminating poverty from this multi-sided perspective and dealing with the fact that we are going into, it's like moving from the horse and buggy to, you know, manufacturing.
Ethel, we are short on time, so I want to make sure to get a couple of final thoughts in, especially from listeners. Sure. We have a call from a listener, Rebecca in San Francisco. Welcome, Rebecca.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
If you could keep it brief, we're a little short on time.
Sure. I guess I wanted to touch upon the difference between happiness and poverty and the stigma around poverty, that it's this depressed, people turn to drugs, and it really, it's quite different than that. I've found a deep happiness since I've been going in and out of poverty, and that our culture is very, very attached to our things and to our society status. And so it's just to keep in mind that to start changing the conversation about what poverty is, and even the word, I'm tired of the word. So just shedding a new light on that happiness has nothing to do with amount of money.
Rebecca, actually, I think you gave us a pretty interesting way to kind of wrap up this conversation when we think about how we want to change the big conversation in our society about poverty. Mia Birdsong, I think you at FII have done, for instance, you talk more about low-income individuals than you do about poor individuals. When you think about framing this, how we actually change the debate, are there some important choices about language and attitude we need to have?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that some of the reason that we're not hearing about having this conversation on a larger scale in terms of, you know, the presidential election is because people like poverty seems so depressing and just entrenched. And I think when we talk about mobility and we talk about, you know, what's the American dream? It's about people being able to work hard, make choices, and seize opportunities to move themselves forward. I really think we need to frame it in terms of the opportunity we have. I think it's important to point out the things that are not working, but it needs to be framed in terms of opportunities if we really want people to get excited about it. There's so much room for innovation here. There's so much room for people who are experiencing this to work together to move themselves forward. There's so much room for those of us who can change policy and can create great programs to be doing things in a way that is not the way we've been doing it for the last 50 years.
Ethel, if I can get a last quick thought from you, Ethel Longshot, before we go, really 15 seconds.
Sure. Our nation currently has sufficient resources to end poverty, but it's structurally, legally to protect profit-making of the corporations on Wall Street. We are going to have to mount a new kind of social movement to change those priorities.
Lauren Needle from United Way, the last word to you.
I just say we need to think about people as a resource and an opportunity, and the more that we invest in the people in our community who are struggling, the more we're going to see that we're all better off.
Thank you so much. It's been a great conversation. Thanks to everyone who's called this morning on your call, as well as those who have emailed. We're just hearing from Lauren Needle. He's the Chief Community Investment Officer at the United Way Bay Area, which has made its mission to reduce poverty in the Bay Area by half by 2020. Before that, you heard from Ethel Longscott, Executive Director of the Women's Economic Agenda Project, and also Mia Birdsong with the Family Independence Initiative. You can find information about all their work and learn more about the program Your Call at our website, yourcallradio.org. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. I'll be back in just a moment to tell you what we have in store tomorrow. Does Occupy still matter? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with two Occupy Wall Street activists, Jen Waller and Tom Heintz, who've been traveling across the country with their project Less Wall, More Street, talking to people about how to fight state repression of protest. Close to a year after it began, has Occupy changed the conversations we're having about the economy and our democracy? And as the presidential election approaches, will the voices of the 99% be heard? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.